It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. There is a very common question that people in Iowa ask today that would have been rare even 20 years ago. The question is, what is that big white bird? And the person that they ask is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Hello, Jim.
This morning.
Thank you so much for being here.
I'm very happy to be here. It's a gorgeous day in Iowa, and seeing lots of big white birds.
Right. Well, you were just out on the rivers, right?
Yes, I've been paddling quite a lot this summer for the Water Trails program and paddling a lot of Iowa rivers. I think I'm up to over in the last two summers over 1,400 miles now. So on Iowa, a bunch of different Iowa rivers and streams. So it's been a great experience, and I'm seeing particularly recently, because I've been paddling some central Iowa rivers that are large and run into lakes. The Des Moines runs into or becomes Sailorville Lake, and then Red Rock farther down. And, of course, many of these birds are quite common around there.
And, of course, you don't have to be on a river to see big white birds in Iowa.
No. In fact, I'm sure that they've been seeing them this summer up on the Great Lakes in northwestern Iowa, up around Okoboji and Spirit Lake and those areas as well.
Well, and a couple of weeks ago, I was walking around Ada Hayden in Ames and had a very low flyover from a pelican.
That's
so
great.
You don't have to travel far.
No,
but
that's right.
I do remember back in, it must have been in the early 90s, there was a whole bunch of fuss because on the Cedar River in Waterloo, there was a little group of white pelicans, and everybody rushed over to see if they could spot them because they were such a rare sight. And I suppose that was a long time ago now, but in environmental terms, it wasn't that long ago
right.
It was really rare to see pelicans.
Yeah, and they have recovered, as most other species have, from basically the DDT problems of the 1950s and 60s. When we finally banned them, we banned DDT, we found, geez, the birds can given a chance, given enough habitat, they can actually recover, and they have indeed recovered very well. So we actually have a lot of white pelicans now that are summering over in these are non-breeding, for the most part, pelicans that it takes several years before they get old enough to breed. And so they summer on our lakes and our rivers, and so we're seeing them all over the state. And there is actually one successful breeding colony now in the state of Iowa. It has been for several years over on the Mississippi River, about Clinton County. It's on an island. And this is very typical for white pelicans because they are island nesters. They're colonial birds. They nest in big colonies. From a few dozen to several thousands of pairs, depending on the size of the island. And they lay their eggs right on the sand there, sort of in a scrape, essentially. And that makes them, being ground nesters, makes them very vulnerable. That's why islands, and they have to be pretty permanent islands. They can't just, if the water gets low later in the summer or midsummer and predators are able to get out to the island, or if it's too close to shoreline, those colonies don't survive. There have been some attempts in some of the lakes in northwestern Iowa, and they've all been predated especially by raccoons and foxes and all kinds of things. love those eggs, and the birds aren't able to protect them, and so they get predated. So, but it is very cool to see them back in Iowa now.
And they are a migratory species.
Yes, yeah, they migrate and winter down around the Gulf Coast of Florida, clear around through Texas, and into Central America. But most commonly seen around the Gulf Coast, which is very interesting because these breed on freshwater lakes in North America, and yet they overwinter in salt water and brackish water around the Gulf. So they're able to make that adaptive change, and that's not easy to do. So it's quite interesting.
Well, let's go back in time pre-DDT. Were pelicans common in Iowa then?
Well, that's a good question, and there's sort of disputes about how common they were. Certainly they were here, and certainly there were some nesting colonies, but how many there were and how common they were is really up for dispute. They certainly were here. I think Lewis and Clark reported them in their journals. So it's, you know, they were certainly here, but how many, nobody really knows. That's kind of messy.
Well, and looking around online and doing a little bit of research, it looks like their migratory patterns have brought them further into Iowa than they used to come.
Right.
And what is some of the speculation about why that might be changing?
Well, it could be a number of things. One, it's availability of fish, the availability of big lakes, things like Sailorville and Coralville and Lake Red Rock. Those all contribute to making habitat available. Also, the fish in them. These are fish-eating birds, and we'll talk a little bit in a minute here about how they eat them. But so you've got to have a habitat, and that's food, water, and shelter, and those lakes are now providing it. So my suspicion is that it's probably the availability of that kind of habitat. Now, as you mentioned in the intro, we do see them on Iowa rivers, but usually they're rivers that are either nearby or close or connected to larger lakes in the area.
And when do they start showing up in the spring?
Well, we'll start seeing them. We don't see them much in most of interior Iowa until, late June, early March, but they can be seen during migration earlier than that, often in May for the most part, along the Mississippi Flyway and some into the Missouri as well.
And then when do they disappear?
Well, they will disappear, and this is the other thing that's kind of interesting. They've been sort of staying longer and longer into the fall. I think I saw some late September, the very last week of September, which is, kind of unusual because they usually will leave late in the summer, early September, mid-September. But seeing them late September is, that's getting up there. So, so we'll see them into the fall. And probably climate change has an awful lot to do with that because we're seeing lots of birds later than we used to and earlier.
So. All right. Well, let's talk about that amazing pouch that they have. I mean, how do they catch fish?
Well, this is fascinating because they also eat some crayfish and salamanders, but I think that most of that is what comes up as they go through the water. These birds will hunt singly for fish, and certainly they're able to find some. But oftentimes they use what's called cooperative feeding, and they're just amazing. They'll get in the shallows and work towards a shallower end of an area and sort of push the fish inland. And their beaks are in the water, so they're swimming or walking on the bottom, as it might be, and gobbling up the fish and putting them in the pouch as they move shallower and shallower. And I had an experience last year that I have, and I've seen them cooperatively feeding quite often. Usually you'll see them in big circles, and they'll kind of move that circle in and sort of push the fish in, trap the fish in amongst them all, and a lot of them then will feed at once. But I had an experience on Lake Odessa over in southeastern Iowa last summer when it was right on dark. I was camping on Lake Odessa and paddling that area, and I was sitting by the lakeshore, and I could see several hundred pelicans across the lake. Being big white birds, they're pretty visible.
Right.
And they came flying over down in front of me. It was too dark to – right on dark, and it was too dark to take any pictures. So I just sat there in awe. And they lined up, and part of the line was closer to the beach than the other, so it was sort of a diagonal. And they lined up shoulder to shoulder, wing to wing, and started coming towards shore. And there are hundreds of birds kept coming in and coming in. And as they moved towards shore, of course, they were trapping fish closer to shore. And as the one end of the line got too close to shore, those birds would get up and fly to the outer end of the line, and it kept going up the shoreline. It was like they were one large organism.
Wow.
It was just phenomenal seeing this cooperative feeding. And again, I've seen, you know, a couple of dozen birds do this, but this was hundreds of birds, and they were all lined up and marching towards shore. It was just phenomenal to see. It is a very effective, obviously. And these were birds that were migrating in late September in southeastern Iowa, and the next day they were gone. They had already headed south.
And they must also be able to fish independently.
Yes,
they
can.
That sounds a lot harder.
Yeah, it is. And again, it's done with the beak in the water, and they have, of course, totally web feet, and so they can swim actually quite fast. It's fun to, if you're behind them, take a look through your binoculars, or if you're close enough to see them, and their wings almost act like outriggers for them. They don't fold them close to their body. They're out to the side and balance them and serve as sort of outriggers to keep them straight up and down as they go through the water.
And if a big white bird flies overhead quite a ways up, how do you know it's a pelican?
This is a great question, because pelicans, although they are big and white, their outside of their primaries and their secondaries are black. So you'll see this soaring bird, or more often 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 of them, soaring together, and they all have their outer primary feathers and secondaries are all black. So a big white bird with black edges means it's a pelican. They fly with their neck tucked in, and of course you can sometimes, if they're close enough, you can see how orange that bill is, and the feet are bright orange as well.
Do they say anything when they fly?
Not much. Not like geese.
No. All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today, and we're talking about the big white birds of Iowa. So far, we've talked about pelicans. We'll talk about egrets. We'll talk about trumpeter swans. And, of course, you can join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, with me, wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and we are talking about Iowa's big white birds. We've been talking about pelicans so far, and we've got a few emails. Jim, this one's from Teresa. She says, the first time I saw pelicans in eastern Iowa was in 1993 when the fields around the Coralville Reservoir were flooded. I was driving down the highway and saw hundreds of them in the flooded fields. I was in awe. I kept coming back day after day because they were so beautiful, and they stayed for at least a month. I love them so much, especially when they're in flight. And it is remarkable to think about how recently we just didn't see them
exactly
at all.
Yeah, it is. It wasn't that long ago, as you point out. For those of us who are older, it was yesterday. You know, but it is truly remarkable to be able to see them now. And I like to see surprise drivers and hear from folks like her that say, gee, I remember the first time I saw
right?
them. So, yeah, that's great.
Here's a question from Robin, since these are migratory birds, and Robin points out that she is not a big white bird, but she would like to know, are these birds carrying the bird flu virus that has hit the state of Iowa poultry industry?
This is great. And this is a whole question that I'm still in the process of researching, because I know what has come out in the public, and this is often the case, I will say, that anything that hits domestic livestock is immediately blamed on wild birds or other wildlife, mammals. And that has certainly been the case in this case. And I keep hearing on the radio that they're saying, oh, it's going to come back again in the fall as the wild birds migrate, they'll carry it. Well, it's certainly possible that wild birds are carrying it. But to my knowledge, and I have not been able to find confirmation one way or the other on this, yes, to my knowledge, they have not isolated the callers, if the knowledgeable callers should let us know otherwise if this is not the case. But to my knowledge, they have not isolated the genetics of the bird flu and specifically been able to attribute it to wild ducks or geese or swans or whatever. That's a supposition that it came from wild birds. But it certainly didn't spread from flock to flock that way. I think the most recent newscast where it talked about we made some mistakes, we know a lot more about it now. The spreading from flock to flock, particularly in north central and Iowa and northwest Iowa, was not wild birds that were doing that. And viruses like this are common. And whenever you put birds in very large enclosures, they are and have not a lot of genetic diversity among when you have a monoculture, diseases spread very, very quickly among them. Now, whether or not it came from wild birds, I think, as far as I can tell so far, is really supposition and not proven.
All right, let's go to the phones. Wolfgang is on the line from Solon. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Yeah. Oh, I was just wanting to comment. I grew up on the river in Burlington, you know, close to the river, and I hung out there all the time when I was a kid. And I never saw a pelican down there. But
right.
When I moved up here, we just live over here by Lake Beside, and they're just awesome. They come down there, and I've seen them in the spring. And then, you know, I said, there's pelicans here. I just was talking to my wife, and then we see them then leaving in the fall, and they just, you know, they take off, and then they circle. Evidently,
yeah.
They're looking for thermals.
Yep.
And, you know, you can see hundreds of them up there, and they're just really cool. And I actually, there's actually some that sit there on the lake, I think, all summer long. We, you know, mm-hmm. see a few of them there, and then in the fall they gather and evidently make their migratory route through here. So it's really cool. I just want to make that comment, you know, that I never knew they existed until.
Yeah.
I grew up
in Burlington too, and I never saw them as a kid, so it's really wonderful to see them back. And you're exactly right what they do. I mean, these birds, this is the largest bird in terms of wingspan in all of the eastern U.S. The only bird that has a longer wingspan is a California condor. These birds have up to 10 feet wingspans.
Wow.
Yeah. these are big birds. They'll weigh 12 to 25 pounds, something like that. But and bill to tail, this is a bird, if you stretch them out and measure them, this is a 4 to 5 foot long bird. But 10 foot wingspan. They have to kind of run on the water a little bit to take off, not a long ways, but a little ways. And Wolfgang's description of how they circle around, that's exactly what they're doing. They're finding a thermal. As they fly around in circles, the thermals are these rising warm air currents that come often off of lakes, especially in the fall of the year as the lakes are cooling off, the warm air rises off of them. And they'll get up high enough on those thermals and set their wings, and they don't have to move a wing again except to maybe bank one way or the other a little bit for 20, 30, 40, 50 miles.
Wow, very efficient flyers.
Very efficient, yes. It's amazing to watch them. And you'll see them, and they're pretty silent as they climb. Unlike other large birds like from geese to sandhill cranes that talk as they climb, all of a sudden you suspect you're seeing something out of the corner of your eye, and you look up and here are these very quiet birds climbing and climbing and climbing up this thermal, circling around. It's just remarkable.
Here's a question from Ben. He says, as a landowner and a farmer in Iowa, what's the best way to create habitat that will assist in the survival of the big white birds when one is farming corn and beans or surrounded by corn and beans?
Yeah, right. Basically, it's a matter of, as Ben points out, it's habitat, habitat, habitat. And these birds have got to have... These are lake birds. Small farm ponds of, you know, a quarter to 1 acre are not big enough to hold them. You need larger lakes than that. And that's the thing that's been happening, I think, Charity, going back to one of the first questions you asked about why is it we're seeing so many more now and looking at the range of their spread. And it is due to the mainly human creation of some of these larger lakes. Ada Hayden in Ames here is a fairly large lake that was created because of mining of the gravel. There are a number of lakes like that around the state. Coralville, Sailorville, Red Rock, those are all creations by damming up major rivers and creating large lakes behind them. So those large lakes are what hold them. The only naturally large lakes in the state are in the northwestern part. The Great Lakes in northwest Iowa. So,
of course, a farm pond can be great habitat for other critters.
Other big white birds, as a matter of fact. I will point out the other two we're going to deal with today, trumpeter swans and great egrets, they will farm ponds if they're sufficient size and sufficiently have a decent habitat around them will attract both trumpeter swans and great egrets.
Well, I think we should move on. But before we do, with both the egrets and the trumpeter swans, hunting is a big part of their history in the state of Iowa. What about pelicans?
No evidence, to my knowledge, that I'm sure pelicans were harvested, particularly for their eggs and probably some for their meat. Especially by Native Americans, but I don't know of any history. That probably were never common enough in the 1800s that they were hunted very heavily. I could be wrong in that, but I don't recall anything in history where I've seen pictures or descriptions of people hunting white pelicans in Iowa at all. So
all right.
I would doubt it.
Now, the great egrets, that's a different story because they have those beautiful, beautiful feathers that people coveted.
Yes.
And perhaps still do, but...
Yeah. During the breeding season, they have those big, beautiful, long plumes. So this is a bird that's big and white. These are the great egrets. They have long black legs and a yellow bill. And they're usually seen alone or standing silently in shallow water of streams and rivers and lakes, just waiting for that fish or frog to swim by. And then they make this incredible lunge with their beak down into the water and come up often with a with that fish or frog. They can, unlike the swans and the pelicans, they don't have to run in the water. They can leap into the air, and they're immediately in flight. And you're talking about a bird that is actually pretty pretty tiny. They only weigh about 2 pounds, but they have a 5 to 6 foot wingspan. And so this is a big white bird, but they're seen in different kinds of habitats, and their history, as you point out, is very, very different. Great egrets were in Iowa. They nest often with other heron species, especially great blue herons, and so they have these colonies of sort of a mixed colony of heron species, usually with just great blues and a few great egrets scattered in, and. What happened with egrets is that they were killed for their long breeding season plumes and feathers from the back of their head and their back, and they were taken for their for these feathers, but because they only have them during the breeding season in the late 1800s, they were killed, shot during the breeding season, which of course is precisely the time that. So you very quickly, if you
can really damage a population.
Oh, damage
that
the
way.
Population is just goes right down, and in fact, at the time, and these were all for women's hats. In those years, I've seen some statistics at the time. This haberdasheries, which are hat making factories, were. Incredibly important economically. In fact, one in every 1,000 Americans was employed in the women's hat making industry in the latter part of the 19th century,
wow.
Which is just amazing. We don't think of that today, but that was huge. And they not only got then feathers from egrets, but that they did take feathers from pelicans, so there was some shooting of them, and certainly trumpeter swans were taken for their meat and sometimes their feathers as well. But there were lots of other birds that were going down the tubes very, very quickly. And it's the reason that the great egret is the symbol of the National Audubon Societies, because they were the first. They weren't the first, but they were among the emerging groups and individuals that were saying, "Wait a minute, this is nuts," and noticing the extreme loss of wildlife species at the turn of the last century. So one in every 1,000 Americans. It's just hard to believe, but they were employed in the haberdashery industry at that time.
Now, are great egrets a migratory species as well?
Yes, they are. They will migrate, down to the Gulf, into Central America, Mexico and that. But most often, many of the ones from here in the Midwest end up in all around the Gulf states, Florida, Louisiana, Texas, all down through there.
Well, and you mentioned that often we see them a solitary great egret, or, you know,
right.
They even if you see a few, they're sort of spread out. They don't
right.
seem to be together. Do we see big flocks of these birds?
Well, not usually. You'll see them in migration is very different for herons than it is for a number of other birds. While you will see some occasional mixed flocks, it seems like that they tend to kind of go in fits and starts, depend on the weather a lot. They cannot make as great a use. They certainly use thermals, but not as great a use as pelicans do. So they're not quite as efficient. So they tend to migrate along with other herons to the south in small groups to I rarely see very large groups of migrating herons. It seems like they'll kind of hopscotch as they go farther south.
Do they nest in colonies, or again, is that a solitary thing?
No, they nest in colonies, and that's when they'll nest often with these are in the trees, not on the sand, like the pelicans are. So they're nest in trees, and often in mixed flocks with great blues and some other species occasionally, but colonial nesters, and there's great strength in numbers. And as a kid growing up along the Mississippi, we used to know where the heron rookeries were, or their heronries were, and we could paddle back in there. And you could usually smell them a great ways ahead of time as well. But they will
nest. Because of the fish smell? Or
yeah,
yeah.
And
okay.
The defecating on the trees. You could definitely smell it. And they don't necessarily just nest on low trees on islands like I used to think they did when we grew up, because they will often nest in high trees, often a mile or more away from water in upland forests. Several times I've come across rookeries of smaller rookeries, 12 to 20, 25 nests, heronries that are in upland forests near rivers, but again, a mile to 2 miles away is not all that unusual.
And we are seeing a lot more of them. What do we know about the level of the great egret population in Iowa?
Well, I would defer that question, I guess, to until we see the results of the breeding bird survey, the latest breeding bird survey that's been going on for a couple of years. They certainly are, I would say, they are back from the brink, very much healthier populations. They tend to they're certainly not anywhere near as numerous as the very common great blue heron is. With whom they nest, but they're certainly spread across the state, and they do make use of a variety of habitats, from ponds to lakes to rivers. Now, I'm being cautious about this because not only do I not know what their numbers are going to be after the breeding bird survey, But they're certainly impacted, as many of these birds are. Because they are fish eaters, they're at the top of the food chain. And there are things happening in that food chain now, certainly with the health of our rivers, that is a potential threat. We don't know the impact of many chemicals or the synergistic impacts of chemicals. And I'm not just talking about farm chemicals here. I'm talking about chemicals that we all take every day, everything from aspirin to ibuprofen, as well as birth control pills and, on and on, pharmaceuticals that our sewage treatment plants don't remove. So the synergism of those chemicals is something I'm very cautious about, and I think the fish eaters of the world, like great egrets, might be under threat down the road.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about the big white birds of Iowa this hour. We've been talking about white pelicans and great egrets. We'll talk about trumpeter swans, and we'll also take your calls. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. I'm here with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here with me today. We're talking about the big white birds of Iowa so far, pelicans and great egrets. And we're going to answer a couple other questions about pelicans before we move on. And then we'll talk about trumpeter swans as well. You can join the conversation with your questions and your observations. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Dan is on the line in Mitchellville. Hi, Dan.
Yes.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I wanted a little clarification first on what you just said about the great egrets. Now, the blue herons, do they share their community with the great egrets? Which is something I've never seen.
Yes. They're colonial nesting birds, water birds, in particular herons, seem to be pretty tolerant of one another. And often you'll see these colonies of or heronries, we'll call them, of great blues. And there'll be a few mixed in great egrets as well that nest with them. So, yeah, they will share those colonies. In Central and South America, I've seen colonies that have other species mixed in as well, everything from cattle egret to snowy egrets to cormorants. They're, because they're all colonial nesting species and they'll nest on these low trees on islands, often they're mixed in. And here in Iowa, what we see is great blues and great egrets sharing a colony in the same area.
Well, I didn't know that. I saw down on the South River in the interstate a couple years back, I saw a heronry. It was along the interstate, and there was only blue herons in it.
Sure,
but
yeah.
The other question I actually had was, how do the feeding habits of the white pelican and the brown pelican compare?
Oh, that's great. Great question. Yeah. And the brown pelicans, of course, we don't have in Iowa, but those of you who travel, the snowbirds of our listeners that travel down to the Gulf Coast may see both in the wintertime.
I was stationed in Florida.
Oh, fantastic. Then you've seen the hunting habits. Very, very different. White pelicans stay in the water and often form these little circles where they'll sort of crowd in the fish in the shallows using cooperative feeding, whereas brown pelicans actually dive directly, folding their wings back and dive into the water from, it seems like, often great heights, but not usually 10 to, 30 feet above the water. They'll dive straight in with bill first and come up with a fish that way. So very different feeding habits for sure. And brown pelicans are smaller, too, quite a bit smaller.
Okay, I didn't know that. The thing that I love most about the white pelicans is the optical illusion that they present when they are in their kettle and they circle from a distance.
Yeah.
They appear to totally disappear and then they reappear, and I love to watch that.
That's a great description. It is an optical illusion because they tend to, being all white but having a black outer feathers of secondaries and primaries, as they turn often up in the sky, is what you're talking about there, Dan, is they seem to blend into the sky and do disappear. It's really quite beautiful. You're right. You're right. That's a great description.
Dan, thank you so much for your call. And Doug is up next in Dubuque. Hi, Doug.
Hi. I had a couple questions. One major one. One was about 3 years ago, my brother-in-law Jay and I were roughing a shed that I had built, and we've seen thousands and thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of pelicans migrating south.
Really?
And,
wow.
In the fall. Yeah, we live right in Dubuque, Iowa, and he's bringing the shingles up, actually, and saw them, and I mean, it was like of epic proportion. We never seen anything like this before in our life. Then we haven't again. And I was just curious if there's, if we could follow this on the computer, follow the pelican migration, if there's a place on the internet that you can go to.
You would like to see it again.
Boy,
huh?
Yeah. Not that I know of. I've never seen groups that big. I've seen hundreds of thousands of cranes migrating together, but I've never seen that many pelicans. Usually it's in the neighborhood of 100 to several hundred birds. That's amazing.
That's a huge amount. In fact, he said usually something cataclysmic follows that.
Yeah, a big snowstorm or something, yeah.
we both looked for it several times, and he lived down south of us, and he said he's never seen it again like that either, and I was just curious if there's any...
I'll bet there was a big storm coming or something, and they were hightailing it out of the North Country. That I've never heard of a quite that large a migration. Again, I see them in large groups. There were probably 1,000 birds that I saw last year in the fall at Lake Odessa. And when they got up, but they got up in groups of several hundred to then go on farther south. The estimates that I've seen, and these are pretty wild estimates, I think, is that there appear to be something in the range of 500,000 white pelicans today across the North America. So that may be an underestimate, but those are the estimates that I've seen anyway.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your call, Doug. And I'm sure that after the fact, birding groups probably lit up with conversations about that kind of migration.
Yeah.
It's really hard to predict it.
Yeah, I think what he's talking about is oftentimes you see on the new radar systems that they have can track large migrating groups of birds, and if he knew the day and that, maybe they could go back in history and find that. But I've never heard of one quite that large.
Right. Okay. Well, we're getting down to the end of the hour. We need to talk about trumpeter swans.
Right.
We have recently. We've talked about how they really were brought back in Iowa in a very intentional way, a very successful program. And now, again, it's a fairly common but still breathtaking sight.
Yeah, breathtaking
to
bird.
See
trumpeter
swans.
And this is another big bird. And we're talking just like the great egrets. They're all white feathers, but they have black feet and a black face, black beak. And this is a bird that has up to a 9-foot wingspan as well. So this is very, very big bird. Now, unlike the other birds, instead of flying with their necks tucked back in an S, trumpeter swans fly with their necks outstretched, and they flap practically all the time. Because this is a 25 to 35 pound bird, they're not as light on their feet. They have to kind of run across the water to get airborne, and they need to flap all the time. So it's very different than the egrets or the pelicans, and this bird is a solitary nester. Unlike the other two that were colonial nesters, trumpeters are solitary nesters, and they're vegetarians. They eat primarily plants, and they probably take in some incidental aquatic insects and the
but not
bottom.
On purpose.
Not on purpose. Although the young swans, the cygnets, do they for their first 5 or 6 weeks they need huge amounts of protein.
Really?
Yeah, and they can't get enough, so they'll eat a lot of aquatic invertebrates when they're out there. They're like most waterfowl. They are. Fully feathered, they have down at birth once they hatch out, and they are precocial birds that are out swimming around with their parents within 24 hours after they've hatched. So they don't hang around in the nest for very, very long. So they're dabblers, and you'll see them often in lakes with their rear ends up in the air as they stretch that long neck down into the bottom and eat plants, aquatic plants in the water. So they have recovered from extremely low numbers. I think the numbers were 69 that total across the country, and they began captive breeding programs. And they've been brought back. They it was not a question of just habitat with them. Their numbers were so extremely low that they had to be brought back. And beginning in Iowa in the 90s, started putting pairs out in Iowa. And they'd hoped to have something like, I think the goal was 15 free-flying nesting trumpeter swan pairs by 2003, and they reached that in 2004, and there are 40 or 50 pairs across the state today. So they're not super common, but we now have, from 69 in 1933, we now have over 5,000 trumpeter swans in the Midwest. So
really brought back from the brink. Is it considered to be a healthy population?
Yeah, I think they're doing very well. There are lots of threats to being a big white bird. makes you there are lots of threats to that. Certainly to among them, shooting accidentally or on purpose is always a threat. I'd say the major threats are more subtle than that. One of them is anglers, please take note of this. One threat is just what's called abandoned fishing tackle. I have picked up in paddling the 1,400 miles of rivers that I paddled the last two summers, I picked up hundreds and hundreds of yards of abandoned fishing line. Sometimes people can't retrieve it, but most times they can.
I've picked it up just running bike trails along rivers.
Yeah.
I've picked up so much, and
it
does seem to be a really common habit to just discard it.
Yeah, and it's just carelessness, I think, because it's particularly with today's line, the braided line, and everything. That stuff cannot be broken. Birds will pick it up or think they can pick it up for their nests. Or if it's along a shoreline, these big white birds get tangled in their feet, in their wings, and it can be deadly, absolutely deadly. So picking that up, make sure that it gets properly disposed of, not just thrown into a lake or something. And certainly the lead sinkers that can be easily digested, cause lead poisoning, those are threats. The other threats are certainly habitat, and habitat. And I think we have, we mentioned threats from synergistic impacts that we don't understand and we haven't even begun to understand of chemicals in the water. So water quality is a big issue, I think, down the road for them. But so trumpeters have made definitely from the brink. Egrets, great egrets especially, certainly from the brink come back. And pelicans were on the downward, severe downward slide, and it was only because we banned DDT use in the United States in 1973 that they've they and bald eagles and a bunch of other things have come back. So these species, you know, are showing what we as a society, I think, can do if we make the right decisions based on science, and we listen to the scientists, and we make decisions that are often very unpopular among some people that are profiting from their utilization in ways that you know, are not sustainable. And they scream and holler. I see this now with the proposed rule to create a season for turtles in Iowa. Turtles are the only thing, the only game species that are taken during the breeding season in Iowa. And that just seems silly to me. Everything else, we have seasons, we have bag limits, should have it for turtles as well. And I think, you know, some folks are screaming and hollering about that because they're profiting from not having a season on them, and that's a shame. So we'll talk about that on another program, I think. But
with a success like the trumpeter swans, it strikes me that it would be easy to get complacent.
Oh, it would be very easy. Yeah, exactly. And that's why I say I think we have to be vigilant. You can't rest on your laurels and say, geez, these came back, though. They're fine now. We have to be vigilant, I think, and those of us who watch them. And we have to continue the scientific research on them and see what are the next threats down the road. And I mentioned a couple today. Certainly habitat is a very big one in Iowa, and we've got some good success, so let's keep it up. Let's not assume that they're always going to be there. We can't do that.
With the trumpeter swans, I mean, we've been very closely watching the population since reintroducing the trumpeter swans, and it's been on an upward trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
Are there predictions about how large this population could be? What the carrying capacity is?
That's a great question, and I don't know that anybody's run a model on that. Certainly, we expect it to creep up because they are, you know, these birds nest in relatively small water bodies, and there's really only one that a pair will only tolerate. A lake will only tolerate one pair on, particularly on a pond, small water body, and so they'll spread slowly, and their reproductive effort, even though they'll lay, you know, quite a few eggs, usually the survival rate of those young is only 2, 3, 4 maybe survive if they're lucky. So they don't necessarily a given pair is not necessarily successful every year. They can get their nest destroyed. They can, during migration, one of the pair gets lost, so they have to go through the whole mating process again, pairing up. So there are, you know, the fact that they're migratory, the fact that they're exposed to all sorts of threats all along the migratory route makes it, we've got to keep our eyes open. We should be happy that we've done what we've done, but we've got to continue to make the right decisions as a society.
And for now, we should just enjoy
Absolutely.
Watching all of these big white birds. Jim, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. My guest today, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He comes by once a month to talk about Iowa's wild creatures and wild places. So we'll be doing that again in September. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.